Sled Dog Podcast, Episode 3, Interview with Dr. Tim Hunt. Hi, welcome to the Sled Dog Podcast. This is Tim.
And this is Gina. And this is the podcast that directs, defines, and helps you digest dog sledding.
Digest dog sledding. I get it, because we're talking about food today.
Yep, we're going to be talking to Dr. Tim Hunt, who is the maker of Momentum Dog Food.
Yep, Dr. Tim is located in northern Michigan. He's not only a veterinarian, but he also is a man with a passion on premium dog nutrition. We were able to catch up with him the day before he was heading off to Yellowknife for a speaking engagement, and he just shared with us a lot of great ideas on not only nutrition, but also some fantastic things to think about during dog racing. He and his wife live in northern Michigan, and they've got a kennel where Dr. Tim not only is a veterinarian, but he also helps people like us, people that really don't know that much detail about the ins and outs of good dog nutrition, to understand and rely on good quality dog food. So we, my wife and I, Gina, were thinking about, you know, what's the best food for our dogs. We've tried multiple different things, and we realized that we need to start planning out what our dogs are going to eat and how they're going to get ready for the racing season. So we thought, who better to go to than Dr. Tim? So we've got an interview with him. It's about 25 minutes long, and then we're going to be following it up with an interview with Black Ice Dog Sledding Equipment, Shalon Bedford, and she gave us a great insight on what to look for in puppies and how to raise up some puppies, and we're going to be touching base with her on a couple of different episodes here to kind of just help people that are getting into the sport on what to look for in younger dogs and how to grow them up in the proper way.
Before we start, Tim, I wanted to share something that happened with us regarding nutrition in our dogs and a mistake that we made that we'd like to pass on, just make sure nobody else makes the same mistake. I don't know if you remember the race that we went to, and for some reason I got it into my mind that I would bring along a glucosamine powdered supplement to put into the dog's food when we were traveling away for a race. We were having to stay overnight somewhere, so it wasn't like we were coming home to feed, and I just put the powdered supplement in the dog's food. I immediately noticed some of the dogs like really not liking what I had put in there, but of course because they were hungry, they ate it.
It was just a little bit, too.
Yep.
It wasn't a lot, just a little powder,
just thinking, oh, a little bit of glucosamine couldn't hurt them. But guess what we got the next morning?
We had loose stools everywhere. Yes, I woke up to a mess.
Very loose stools, yes. And these dogs were expected to race. So they raced and they did okay the first day. But by Sunday morning, which is the day of our second race, a couple of them just didn't want to eat their food. They were having very loose stools. And
yeah, we learned the hard way that everything is consistency. No matter what you're doing in training, just to keep it the same way during a race and don't change anything during a race. And we found out the hard way. And since then, as we've talked to other people, they've talked about how they've done the same thing, or somebody has recommended that, you know, try this after a race or whatever, and it's just not a good idea to change anything during a race. And Dr. Tim talks about that a little bit, and he also talks about how hard it is or how easy it is to get sidetracked on what you're feeding, and how it's easier to stick to the basics and go after just a good, solid, nutritional dog food. But he educated us on what to look for in the dog foods and what, more importantly, is the dog needs. And so I think this interview, it's an interesting interview. You know, he took his time out of the day. He was at his clinic. He has a veterinarian hospital up in the northern Michigan. And it was just fantastic that he spent a few minutes with us. So let's go to the interview.
Yeah.
And we'll be talking a little bit afterward with Black Ice Dog Sledding Equipment. And so we'll go probably just right back to back with both interviews. And if you want links to either Dr. Tim or to Black Ice Dog Sledding Equipment, we'll go ahead and put those in the show notes. And again, you can always reach out to us at sleddog@vbs20.com or go to
our website at www.sleddogpodcast.com.
Is that www.sleddogpodcast.com?
No, it's www.sleddogpodcast.com.
Yeah, exactly. See how many times you can say that. Okay, let's go to Dr. Tim.
Dr. Tim, let's start out just with a little history of who you are and how you got into dog sledding.
Sure. When I moved up to the UP, and we started a practice from scratch, so we didn't have any clientele, and I made the unfortunate mistake of thinking that sled dog kennels would be good clientele because they have so many dogs, but little did I know they have very little money. So So that usually that opened the door to me just getting exposed to the sled dog culture, and then actually finding my niche out there. And that I enjoyed the outdoors. I hunted and fished a lot, but I really enjoyed being out with the animals more so in the woods. And I didn't end up having to kill anything to have a good time. You know, like if you were hunting. So what I found was with time of establishing the clinic and working with some kennels, I made the mistake, secondly then, of saying, this would be fun to do. And then someone gave me four dogs, and then I went to eight, and then I went to more. So that's how it kind of started there. And then with my interest, you know, started back in, I don't know when it was, must have been 94, over time of working with different foods and dogs and stuff, I just started to think that we could do better with the nutrition out there, and we started to develop our own food that way. But the sled dog thing has taken me all over the place. I've worked the Iditarod a bunch of times as a vet, and we've raced over in Europe and in Canada and Alaska. So it's been a really great opportunity to get out and see the world in a different way as well. I'm always happy when someone wants to put a sled dog trail in something or in some place that is really a beautiful country, such as the Alps or the Rocky Mountains or Alaska. So if they're willing to do that, I'm willing to show up and run my dogs to it. And to me, it's not that important to perform really well where we have to be in the top five or anything. I like to do well. That's nice, but I just love to be with my dogs. And training's a lot of fun, and then just seeing different parts of the world is the kicker with the whole thing.
Oh, that is wonderful. And you have, what, 35 now?
Yeah, we have about 35 dogs.
That is exciting. And can you rattle off those names for us? No, I'm just kidding. I know you can.
I'm not going to. We tend to name all our dogs after people names, so we have some funny names.
Oh, that's, yeah.
So, now when did you come up to the UP? What year was that?
93.
And the UP, for everyone else, is the Upper Peninsula in Michigan.
Correct.
And where did you hail from?
Well, I grew up in Detroit, and then went to vet school in East Lansing, and then I practiced in northern Lower Michigan for a couple of years in Alpena and Grayling.
Okay.
And Gaylord.
So you're just truly a Michigan boy.
Yeah, I haven't been outside of it.
Well, Gina's from Livonia, and I'm from Cadillac, and then Redford, another.
Well, I'm from Westland,
And
my dad, we had a camp in Manistee. It's actually in Wellston.
Oh, and now we live in Cadillac, so we're just around the corner from Wellston.
Yeah.
We'll cut that stuff
world.
Out. But just,
really
yeah, it's just fun stuff.
Yeah.
Well, Dr.
Anyway.
Tim, tell us one question, and that was, when is it necessary for a musher to start buying professional dog food versus like a grocery store brand food?
I think if you're going to have athletic dogs, period, you should try to aim towards an athletic dog food. There's different levels of dog food that you can get in the athletic variety, but I think you'll definitely notice a difference in performance and just how the dog recovers with a general athletic dog food, period. And what does an athletic dog food mean? You're talking at least 28 to 30% protein-based foods. And I think for any level of exercise, be it a hunting dog or a field trial dog or a sled dog, you've got to get into those protein numbers that are up in that area. Otherwise, because of the muscle use they go through and the type of exercise they go through, they just don't have enough protein available to repair things. So you start to have injuries. So what you'll actually see is, even though you're recreational and you might be using some sort of a less expensive 26% protein type food, is you're going to run into more injury problems just because of the building blocks not being there and being able to fix things. So I would tend to recommend that, you know, even for the people starting right off the bat, that they go to some level of athletic dog food. And what company, what brand, it doesn't matter to me, but just try to get in that protein number, as it really does help out, even if you're running 10 miles a week versus 100 miles a week.
No, that's great. And is there certain things, obviously it's the high protein, you know, so what's a good number in the high protein area?
Well, like I was saying, I would tend to start with somewhere in the neighborhood of 30% protein, 20% fat. I think those are good numbers to begin with to get people off the ground and then moving forward from that point on. And then you could start to integrate other things in if you needed to, be it meat or some of the other ingredients or supplements. There's prepared foods that are in the 35 to 37% protein range that are right on the mark with what you're looking for as to a diet as well. But they're a little trickier to use. They cost a little bit more, and it might be a little bit more than some people want. But it definitely can be used for any level of racing.
Okay. And do you ever, you used to talk about supplements. You know, a lot of the races we go to, we see people, you know, doing some kind of supplements either with raw foods like venison or fish, chicken, that type of thing.
Sure.
Is there anything particular that's better than others, or is it all the same kind of idea for the dog?
No, I think what a lot of people look for is either one of several things. They're looking for a silver bullet that gives them the edge over the competition, and there really isn't a silver bullet. It really boils down to training and training adequately hard for the competition you're going to go against or the type of race you're going to go into. So the supplements to me, I think there's a lot of foo-foo medicine and foo-foo supplements out there where, you know, it's nice in theory, but in practicality, it really isn't adding much. People just shortchange their training versus just cutting out the supplements and putting more time into that. But as to supplements that really do benefit some dogs, again, you're looking at what level of exercise the dogs are going to go into. So with a dog that might be a rec team that's running 10 miles a week, it might be a different type of supplement I may recommend versus a dog team that's running 100 miles a week. So again, we have to kind of weigh what we're trying to achieve as to what supplements to use. But first and foremost, I think a good balanced dog food that's made for an athletic dog is going to have a lot of supplements in there that are going to be beneficial. And then as to adding other things in there, I think the glucosamine derivatives are always good. There's no harm with using that. And then, again, it really boils back to what we're going to do with the dog as to which supplements to use. There's just so many out there and so many different energy pack type ideas that you have to really look at each case separately to see what we're looking at. I mean, I could generalize for sprint people versus distance people somewhat, but overall, that's a tough question.
Now, what about like venison and fish and other, you know, regular animal
sure.
products?
If we get into the whole meat thing, I don't consider those a supplement. I would consider those part of the mainstay of the meal. So as to fish or venison, you're looking at your fat content to that and how much water. So, for instance, fish is going to have about 70 to 80% water. Venison has much less, and it's extremely lean type food. So your differences there are one's fattier and waterier, or more water, the other one's much more dry and almost no fat. So to me, these dogs, let's say if we're going to supplement a dog with food on a regular basis, is that what you mean? Kind of like
yeah,
every day?
Yeah, probably on a regular basis and then also after a race maybe.
Yeah, okay. So on a regular basis, if our main meal is going to be kibble plus a meat item, okay, and we want to always keep things the same in training as racing, so we don't do new things in a race. We have to expose the dogs to the stuff in training, so our meal is going to be constructed and used in training to know how they do on it. But, for instance, going back to the food thing, if our main meal is going to be kibble and a meat item, let's say it's beef, okay,
right.
or fish or venison for that matter, we just need to keep it consistent. I don't care for venison much because it's real lean and you just need a lot of it to get the same bang for your buck versus something a little bit fattier like beef,
okay.
which has more fat. So, of course, fat has twice the energy as regular protein does. So you can see the difference between a pound of venison and a pound of beef. There's more calories in the beef. So I tend to encourage something with more fat in it, and that these dogs burn a lot of fat. And the protein allotment you need to have, but the fat they need more so. So getting back to the bare bones again as to what you're asking, because I'll go way off on a tangent here. you got to look at your meat source as to how fatty and how much protein is there and what quality it is. And I think they're all fairly equal, be it turkey, chicken, or fish, or beef. And then there's others that are definitely leaner, like horse or venison for that matter, that are much leaner, and you might have to compensate with more fat. So the leaner you go with your meat source, the more fat you're going to have to add to the diet is what it comes down to. These guys need a lot of fat because they just burn it up.
That's what I was going to say. Is there a fat supplement, not a supplement, but like I've heard, you know, some people I've seen put oil in or different things. Is that not recommended?
No, it's recommended. I think a lot of people use oils. You have to, again, be aware of what kind of oil you're using. A lot of people will use corn oil or safflower oil as a energy supplement. But again, once you start to mix these things in past just the regular kibble, it starts to interfere with the whole vitamin picture of the meal. So you can't just ramshackle dump it in. Because if you do a lot of oils for a long period of time, you can upset the vitamin balance. Plus also, the GI tract doesn't handle it that well either. So when we're trying to use some extra fat, you have to just, it's just like us. If you go in and eat a whole meal of lasagna at once, it's not going to sit with you well. Whereas if you go in there and have half a piece of lasagna, then maybe the next day you have a bigger piece, then your body gets used to it. And the same goes with these fat sources. So again, there's no one silver bullet where one fat's better than another. That's what a lot of people tend to think is, why are they using that kind of fat over coconut oil? I think there's a lot of similarities there, but people tend to overdo it, looking for that edge.
Would you say that that's probably the most common mistake a musher would make in feeding is the overdoing?
Definitely. They overfeed. Yeah, they overfeed and they change too many things when they get into a race. You know, they think they need to give them a little bit extra. I mean, dogs can do these races without eating anything in many instances. But I think the most common mistake you'll see with mushers is just consistency with their meal plan in the yard and being aware of how each dog reacts to that food.
That is awesome.
Okay.
And so for a recreational musher, you know, that doesn't do more than 10 miles, what should their dog food look like? I mean, is it not just a higher protein, higher fat, but does it need to be a certain corn base versus rice versus something else?
Yeah, I've just never been a big corn fan, so that's why our food's made without corn. And there are a lot of diets with corn in it that do very well. I've just never liked corn and what I seemingly noticed with some of the after effects there. I think the quality of the protein is probably by far the most important thing. Whereas you can get a 30-20 type diet from Walmart, and you can get a 30-20 diet from, let's say, Eukanuba, there's going to be a difference, and it's going to be the quality of the protein. So the types of proteins they use can make a huge difference in the palatability of the food and how digestible it is.
So you mean like the difference between like a chicken versus a chicken parts? I mean,
there's some vagaries there with chicken meal and chicken parts, and there's a lot of ways they can mislead you on the labeling too, and it can be very, very confusing. So my recommendation there is when you're looking at a diet and they have words in there you don't understand, look it up, just Google it, and figure out what it means. I mean, there's a lot of difference between chicken and chicken meal. And really what it boils down to is just the weight of the protein. And first is really getting way into it and confusing everybody. For instance, chicken means it's just raw chicken. Again, it's 70% water. Chicken meal is already dehydrated. So you're getting much more bang for your buck for with chicken meal and a better quality than plain chicken in many instances.
See, I would have thought that was just the other way around.
Yeah, it does, doesn't it? It makes you just crazy. It just boggles your mind. So you just have to be aware of what you're getting and how the label reads. But reading a pet food label can be really confusing, and there's a lot of ways companies use it to their benefit.
Well, exactly. And that's what you know you're going to be reading is whatever's in their benefit.
Yeah, exactly. So they're going to word it certain ways.
Can we touch a little bit on since we talked about overfeeding, on a scenario where you've got an underweight dog because he's so overactive, always running around in a circle, always doing his thing, can't keep weight on him, just looks like he's, what would you do?
All right, well, when I have a dog that seems to be thin, first things we look at is the age of the animal, what kind of diet he's been on, the parasite program that he's on too. So we've got to first eliminate anything, you know, catchy like a parasite, make sure we don't have any worm issue. So do a fecal and make sure that's covered and deworm if we need to. Secondly, if we cover that base and it's not an obvious parasite issue, what we then go to is the food. Evaluate, make sure we're on a decent food. And if we have a whole kennel of dogs and we have one skinny dog, that's different than a whole kennel of skinny dogs. So if we have just one individual dog out of the whole lot that tends to be thin versus all of them, it's going to be an individual problem versus a feeding plan problem or a feeding program problem. You know what I mean?
Right.
Yeah. So if we have one individual dog then that has the skinny appearance that we're not happy with, then I look at the age of the animal. For instance, if we have a yearling animal, anything under 2 is considered a yearling. Those are really hard keepers in many cases because they're still really growing and their metabolism's on overdrive. Secondly, besides the age, is the coat of the dog. A short-coated dog, obviously, is going to burn more energy up than a thick-coated dog. So those houndy breeds tend to be thinner as a rule, too. And then thirdly, the houndy thin-coated dogs tend to digest food a little bit differently because the metabolism is so high in that you can't hit them with a lot at once. Otherwise, it ends up on the floor of the kennel in that it just runs through their system too much. It comes out as soft stool. So with those really high-active, thin dogs, you have to feed them in multiple feedings per day for it to work better. So that's how I kind of go through that.
Feeding 2, feeding 3 times? Okay.
Yeah, it might be twice a day. I like feeding dogs twice a day. I think it works better in my hands. Some people like to feed them once a day, and that's fine. I mean, there's a lot of ways to skin a cat. And in my opinion, I just like twice a day feedings. It just works better for us and for our dogs. But when I have that thin dog that we're trying to get some weight on, you know, I will increase the amount of food per feeding until we get soft stool. Okay, and then I'll back off somewhat. So if we set at a cup and we got solid stool, I'll go to a cup and a half solid stool, I'll go to 2 cups, and it starts to get loose, I'll back down to 1 3/4. And then, you know, divvy that up, 1 3/4 in the morning, 1 3/4 at night. So I try to judge by what's coming out as to how much he can assimilate at one time. And it's really as simple as that. I mean, you can sit down and do all sorts of measurements, but I put food out to see what they can handle, and then if we start to get the positive weight gain and we're not having soft stool or diarrhea, then we're on the right track.
Oh, that makes so much sense.
Yeah, it really is simple.
It's almost too obvious. It's like, oh, duh.
It is. Some things are very obvious, and people get wrapped up in nuances and minutiae.
Sure. Just for everyone listening, though, but could and this is a funny thing to define, but could you define soft stool?
Sure. Soft stool is going to be like soft serve ice cream. So when you go to the Dairy Queen and they fill up an ice cream cone, that's considered a soft stool.
Okay.
You know, I don't know if I can ever eat ice cream again now.
You bet. Yeah, at least brown ice cream.
Yeah, there you go. I'll be eating for now.
Yeah.
Okay, that makes sense. So it's not necessarily runny stools. It's more of just a soft stool.
Right, and runny stools can be a result of overfeeding as well, and it can also result of a lot of other things. But to keep it very simple, because the majority of things in life are simple, that's how I look at those guys. And then there's always some oddities that come out that make them thin too, but we won't go there.
No, that's awesome. And you know, one of the questions we always have, because everybody that's been in dog racing has had a set of puppies or had a litter of puppies.
Sure.
When do puppies come off puppy food and you put them on a more high nutritious professional dog food?
Sure. What I typically do with puppies is once they're dropped in the ground, I let the mom nurse the pups until about 3 weeks of age, and then I'll start to creep feed them. Creep feeding means that we're softening up some puppy food and exposing it to them so they'll start to eat that. And that I do at 3 weeks of age or so. They're still nursing off of mom, but I might pull mom off then a couple of weeks after that. And then we just kind of transition them over to the food that way. I tend to keep them on some level of a real good puppy food, which actually when you read the numbers tend to be very close to what an athletic dog food is going to be with number-wise. So to me, you could run dogs on that puppy food starting at, 6 months, 7 months of age is when we harness break them. And then as to switching over to the really higher end, like the higher percentage protein foods, I might do that later on when they're 10 or 12 months old.
And then put them just right to the adult professional dog food.
I would. Yeah, the adult professional kind of athletic food is very close to what a puppy food is.
To kind of tag on to that, we've talked to some mushers that actually use puppy food for their adult racing dogs. What do you think about that?
Oh, I think it's all right. It really depends on what you see coming out of the dog. Again, puppy foods tend to be 28% protein, so we're pretty close to that 30% plateau that I like to use. And I'll see people use puppy food. I think that's okay. I think there's better foods out there. A lot of times with athletic dog foods, it's not always when we get into the second stage of looking at foods is we look at the protein and the fat content, but fiber content is really huge with athletic dogs. So when we compose a food up, we're looking at what kind of fiber we use in the food that they can utilize to digest for several different reasons. And when you're looking at puppy food, they're not going to have those fiber compositions in it. So I know that dog that's racing on puppy food isn't going to handle it as well as, let's say, an athletic dog food because of the fiber composition that's in there. So that's the next stage of looking at a dog food is just that. So to me, it's the protein fat content, the quality of the protein and the quality of the fat, and then I look at what the fiber composition is in the food. And that'll really relate to how fast that food goes through the GI tract and how they digest it and then what comes out the back end.
That is wonderful. Now, after a race, do you recommend supplementing with anything particular for dogs other than water to get back, back up to steam?
You know, it depends on what we're looking at with this dog, dog team and what they're trying to do. So, for instance, what we'll tend to do is after a run, they usually get exposed to their soaked food within an hour of running. In race situations, it tends to be pretty close to that as well. Some people will use the, like, GlycoCharge and the different types of high energy returns that way to get their glycogen levels back up, and they help somewhat. I think it's more important that hydration happens after a run than anything else. I think a hydrated animal will eat better and they'll have less injury. So training the dogs to eat and drink after a run, okay, is key, and that happens in the dog yard. So dogs eating in a race are trained to do that in the dog yard, and that's where, again, going back to that routine of your dog food plan and training comes into play for the race thing. So I wouldn't change anything after race that I wouldn't do in training. And if they want to use something, after a training run that they want to use in a race, they just need to keep it consistent so the dogs are exposed to it. So again, if I go back to what do I want to use after a run, I think water is number one, so they get water when they come in. Temperature of the water can really dictate if they'll take it or not, warm or cold, and the type of bowl, plastic or metal. And then after that, I usually give them some kibble within 30 minutes of coming in, and it might be a handful. or it might be a whole meal. It depends on how I have my whole structure set up in my kennel. With my time frame being as it is, I usually feed them within half an hour coming in because I just don't have a lot of time between the hospital and running dogs and all that stuff. And they get used to it. And if you're not keeping that kind of a schedule where you feed them within half an hour of a run, I wouldn't recommend doing that until you ease them into it. Otherwise, you could run into a bloat issue of feeding them too soon after a run.
Right.
Keep things consistent is the key.
Right. No, that's huge. And I think that's, you know, amazing how simple it is, but yet you've got to think about it to make sure
you do.
You're on.
You do. Made a lot of mistakes.
I'm sorry. Last question for you. Should a sled dog ever get people food, Dr. Tim?
Should a sled dog ever get people food? Sure, why not? They're our buddies,
I mean, like,
man.
Well, I know, but I mean, should they ever get like breads and the other things? Or
I don't see a reason to it. Carbohydrate levels in a sled dog food should be around 15%. If you're using straight meat and no kibble, you need to figure out what 15% means. So you're going to use some bread or rice to bring those numbers into play. If you're using a dry kibble with meat, you're going to have enough carbohydrates there to make it happen. Dogs are different than people. You don't need to carbohydrate load them before or after an event like you do a person, you know, that might eat a bunch of spaghetti before the big swim meet. Our bodies are different than them. Our requirements are like 40% carbohydrates in our diet. Dogs are usually no more than 15%. If you go past that too much, you actually inhibit their performance dramatically, especially with their lactic acid and stuff. So I wouldn't say you need to do any of that. That's just the human end of it being pulled over the dog end of it, and dogs are not little people.
That is wonderful.
Okay.
So now let's go back to the business that you also run, other than being a veterinarian. And again, when did the business of making dog food take place?
Sure. We started about 3 years ago, and it was after working with a few different foods over the years and mixing in lots of meat, cutting meat up for years. You know, we go through 10,000 pounds of meat a year. I just got tired of it, and I thought, well, we can put something better together in a whole kibble. And that's when we started to develop the food as to what I thought would be the best way to make it happen. And then we just slowly, you know, made some refinements over on and over the years. We got it into some bigger races to see how it does in the Iditarod and the Quest and races around here. And now I really believe we have a really good product. One of these years, someone will win the Iditarod on it. And if
there
they don't,
go.
That's
well,
okay.
Close.
Yeah, we got close. We've got some teams up there in the top 10. And we'll see what happens this year. We'll just keep plugging along. But it's been really fun learning about nutrition. It's quite interesting. There's just so much information out there. You can just get pulled into adding 3,000 ingredients into the food. And to me, you know, if you don't have enough of it in a dog food, you're just doing window dressing. So you can add a lot of things into it to make it look nice, but if you don't have enough to make it worthwhile, then why put it in except to try to lure some people into using your food? So we try to use the supplements or put the supplements in there that I deem worthwhile and then enough of it so it actually is beneficial. And
now
it takes some tweaking over time as we see how things go and, you know, with new developments in dog food and such, if we can add anything else in. Like this year we changed and added in a different vitamin premix to really help with the feet for those splits that you run into and foot pad health. So I'm really excited to see how this year goes to see if we can help diminish that issue that people come across. But diet plays a huge part in that.
Well, you go by two names. You've got Momentum and Pursuit. Is there one for summer, one for winter, or is it different dogs?
Yeah, the Momentum is a 37% dog food. And that's the high-end premium stuff. And the Pursuit is a 30-20 type dog food, which is less high-end. I use the Momentum year-round in my kennel. A lot of kennels do that. Some people like to use the 30-20 because they use a lot of meat.
Okay.
So if they're using a lot of meat and such, then the Pursuit tends to be the one that they use a little bit more.
How'd you come up with the name?
I was reading an astronomy book, and I saw it, and that's how I came up with the name.
Well, now you got to
give us
the
a little more
for
there,
it.
Please.
Yeah, you can do the connection there. What is like momentum of like a planetary momentum?
Yeah, like inertia. You know, just things keep rolling. You know, the whole physics thing of once you get it rolling, you got it going. So the Momentum, and then the Pursuit is, of course, you're catching up on something.
Oh,
just,
that's great.
You know, I thought they were kind of nice.
Yeah.
But it's been an experience, to tell you the truth.
This has been absolutely wonderful for taking your busy time, and I know you're heading off to speak. Are you speaking tomorrow? Or
Saturday and Sunday, I think, up in Yellowknife, way up there.
What's that conference all about?
It's a sled dog symposium they have with the Northwest Territories Sled Dog Group, Grant Beck and all those kind of people. up in that area that they have once a year. It's actually, it's fun. I'm looking forward to it. I've never been up in that section of the world before.
Well, this has been absolutely fantastic. Dr. Tim, you've been absolutely a blessing to us to be able to get on the phone and tell us all the information that you have. This is absolutely wonderful.
Sure. Need anything else, you give me a buzz.
All right, bye-bye. Take care.
Fantastic interview from Dr. Tim. I hope you enjoyed that. He has a great perspective on it. Obviously, it's something that he's been doing for, you know, not only I think 3 or 4 years that they've been producing food, but obviously you can tell that the passion in his voice and his commitment to the quality and nutrition of dog food just comes out through his voice. It's fantastic.
Yeah, that was really interesting. I'm really excited about the next interview as well that taught me just as much.
So let's go to that interview. It's with Black Ice Dog Sledding Equipment. Their webpage is at blackicedogsledding.com. And again, you can get to that information in our show notes at www.sleddogpodcast.com. So let's go ahead and go to that interview. So, hey, Shalon, thank you so much for joining us today, and thank you for helping us as, I don't want to say we're new, but we've been dog sledding for 3 or 4 years now, but there's so much we don't know, and you mentioned to us when we talked to you on the phone that you had some ideas on how to spot a good puppy in a litter, and that is so close to us because we've had puppies this year, and we don't know what to look for, so how can you help us out?
Well, that's the subject I really am very interested in because over the 25 years that we raised Alaskan Malamutes, it was important to us to be able to identify our best puppies in the litter. Some people don't have that luxury. They have the dogs that they have and they need to work with them at that level. But I think anyone who's either purchasing a puppy or has litters of their own, there are some very distinct things that both David and I really like to look at when we're evaluating a litter. And I think everyone sits with their puppies as much as possible as they're growing up, and you learn a lot about them as they interact with each other. But how they act on their own when they are away from the group dynamics of a litter is really more telling about what that dog's personality is going to be like as they mature. One of the things that I have always used is what's called the puppy aptitude test. Once I've evaluated a litter and kind of looked over what I think are my best prospects, at about 7 weeks of age, David and I like to put them through a series of little tests. These were developed by Jack and Wendy Volhard, and you can go to a website that is www.volhard.com, and you can read about this process, and you can also download the test forms. And there's also information about how to evaluate what you're actually seeing on those tests. But you're going to put your puppies one at a time sort of through a little battery of tests. Something such as simple as you'll bring a puppy into the testing area, and we use a tester, a person who's never seen these puppies before and hasn't interacted with them. So we're seeing a puppy's raw, how they respond to that person.
Wow.
Not knowing them. If they know me, they're likely to respond in ways, other ways, because they've socialized with me before.
Because you feed them and you care for them,
right.
They would respond
right.
They're
already bonded to me in some way.
Okay.
So their willingness to do things for me is different than that for a stranger. And I want a little more of a raw type of response for them. And if you've ever seen this test before, we try to take them into an area that's unfamiliar to them, away from the rest of the litter. We carry them to the site, we place them down, and the first thing that tester does is sort of lean back while they're sitting on their knees and call the puppy to them, and we want to see how that puppy responds. And the Volhards have created a scoring sheet that goes from 1 to 6, and they describe what each of those are. And
that's
in that
so neat.
First test, if they come readily with their tail up, but they bite at your hand, they get a 1, all the way down to a 6, which is didn't come at all. The objective for me when I'm looking at these tests and what they recommend is we're looking for dogs that score in the 3 and 4 to 4 range. In this case, it would be a dog that came readily with its tail up. A 4 would be he came readily, but the tail was down. Those are both good responses from a dog. And it goes through a series of things, following, restraining, showing social dominance by holding the puppy down on its back on the ground. We do an elevation test. There's some touch sensitivity and sound sensitivity. But in the end, the objective is to see and find a puppy who's getting all 3s and 4s. one of my favorite tests, and the one I consider one of the most important, is the retrieving test. And while that puppy is sitting next to you, we'll crumple up a piece of paper, and when we've got the puppy's attention, we'll toss that paper out just about 4 feet in front of the puppy. And I want to see that puppy chase the object, pick it up, and bring it back to me.
What does that show you?
Yeah, well, what it shows me is a willingness to please.
Okay.
And to me, that's one of the most important aspects of having a trainable dog. And I have to laugh because there's nothing about that test that isn't applicable to almost anything we do with the dog. If I'm showing a dog, if I'm showing it an obedience, rally, agility, and we're sledding, any kind of performance event, if that dog is willing to please me, he's more willing to learn whatever I ask him to do and pay attention to me as well. So I've always loved a dog that would go run and grab. Now, that's not a typical sled dog characteristic.
Right.
So over many years of selecting and things, we really sort of focused on that till we got to the point where of our litters, a predominant number of dogs would do well on that test.
Wow. So did you see that you'd breed it into the dogs, or is it a characteristic?
You know,
that
and I always think this is an important aspect of breeding good dogs. Besides, you know, if you're raising purebreds, you have some limitations because of breed type and structure and things that you're looking for. But when you select for characteristics and then breed the dogs that show those characteristics the best, you will get a higher and higher percentage of your litter that will show those characteristics. Now, that's not to say they're all going to be perfect, because you've got generations of history behind the dogs that you're using. And when those genes split out, you never know what you're going to get in that mix.
Sure.
It's just like children. They may not look at all alike or act alike. But the more you select for very specific characteristics, like a willingness to please, the more likely you are to see that characteristic over and over again.
Besides the dog's attitude or willingness to please in this case, is there other things that you look for? Do some people breed for height, their strength, or, you know, any other characteristics that you normally see?
Well, because we raised Alaskan Malamutes, we were very focused on the characteristics that actually made that a very breed-specific dog. I think that people choose those characteristics based on what they're doing with their dogs. And just like any, nowadays we see all kinds of dogs that don't look much like sled dogs anymore out on the trail.
Right.
And once again, it's because if you're breeding for speed or you're breeding for a certain distance, you can always improve the genetics of a dog and the possibility of getting a really good dog by doing some blending with other breeds and other dogs of character. So for us, we were somewhat limited.
Right.
Now, one of our most important facts, though, is that once we got beyond that simple puppy evaluation there, we would do a procedure that Mel Fishback described in puppy selection called leash testing. And if anyone has ever read, and the article that I originally got this from was quite old, and I don't have a reference to it, but I can just describe briefly what they were talking about. When the Fishback started evaluating, they tried to find something that would help them pick the best puppies in their litter. And they did what was called a simple leash test. And they would take a puppy who was about 7 weeks old, and they would prefer that the puppy had learned something at that point, so it showed the ability to learn. If you wait too long, there are other factors that interfere. But right at about 7 weeks of age, that puppy is probably now has the ability to learn something. And we're going to put a collar and a leash on them for the first time in their life. And so we'll take that pup, we'll put a small collar on, not a choke collar, but just a simple fabric-type collar and
right.
a light leash, and then give the pup just a little tug and take off walking. And how that puppy responds to the stress of that situation was indicative to them of how well that dog was going to do on their team.
I'm on the edge of my seat because we've done those with our puppies recently. I'm like, okay, what do you look for? The ones that fight or the ones that take off running?
Yeah, this is so exciting because we were very, very committed to selecting what Fishback called the Group 1 puppy. And that's the puppy who you know, may strain just for a moment until it gets the idea of what's going on, and then that puppy is right there with you, if not out in front of you, dragging you along. I prefer that puppy to be right with me, kind of following, because then it shows me they have accepted my authority, they have learned something, and they're willing to be with me. They're very bonded to me. They may hear the other puppies making noise and may glance at them, but they are really focused on the job at hand, what we're doing right now. And you might do this for 2 or 3 minutes and find that they tire and go, oh, maybe I should just sit down. And you give them a little tug, but they're right back there with you again. And when you stop the exercise after a few minutes, they come right up to you. They wag their tail. They may be licking you in the face, going, I'm really bonded to you. And without a doubt, these made our best sled dogs.
That's fantastic. Now, what happened to the dogs that didn't cut it, that didn't do that?
Well, and I'll just say briefly this. They tend to make really good leader dogs, too. And you'll see dogs that do well on the Volhard test will usually do quite well on this test as well. Yeah, the dogs that don't do as well, they then break down into three other groups, the group two, the group three, the group four. Group two dogs, they are a lot more resistive. In fact, they're quite actively resistive. They may fight, they may complain, throw themselves around. But with a little persistence, and sometimes it takes 5 or 6 minutes, you'll usually get them going with you. Although, they aren't that thrilled with you at the end of the exercise. When
right.
you sit down, they're kind of mad that you've made them go through all this. These pups can still be pretty decent team dogs. They'll just take a little more work to make them focused on what they're doing and may not ever turn into a lead dog, but certainly can be good team dogs.
That's wonderful.
The group three dogs were very passive objectors. They would rather get away from you. They would rather go back to their pen. They'd whimper. They'd shriek. They were very reluctant to come along with you. Eventually, sometimes just for the sake of comfort, they eventually go with you because they have to. These dogs rarely make a good sled dog, and I think only a very good trainer can make even a very good performance dog in any event with them. Group fours are real killers. They just throw themselves on the ground and won't go anywhere. And
right.
they're like dead weight.
Big old lazy
and
dog.
You have to laugh thinking, I can't even imagine a puppy doing it, but I have seen it.
Yeah.
We have one.
Very laid-back dog. Yeah. They just don't want to do anything, and they throw themselves on the ground, and you can pull and drag, and they won't even get back up on their feet. And if you stop, they'll sit up for a minute, but the minute you start again, they just toss themselves down on the right. ground. They need to be a good couch potato for somebody because I don't think they're very trainable puppies. But between those two tests, that really helped us make our selection.
Okay, and so percentage-wise, over all these years that you've done this?
Yes, the hard part is, I would say that in about the first 15 to 20 years of raising Malamutes, by the time we were into, 10 to 15 year span, we were getting probably more group ones and twos out of a litter than anything else. Threes and fours were, the rarity. Not that they wouldn't be there, but in a litter of 10, you might have maybe one group four, but you might have three or four group threes and, again, two or three group twos and one or two group ones. And
okay.
and it is that rare. Even with good selection, you may only find one or two that really fit the bill. The longer we were breeding, though, and as you have to work around some other issues, genetic issues and just some of the breeding things that you're looking for beyond working, we diluted some of our lines and we sort of lost that edge, I still had good working dogs, but not quite that real peak we had hit at one point. So it's hard to maintain, It's not easy.
Oh, I'm sure. Can I give you a scenario?
Sure.
Well, we have had a litter of puppies in December. So these guys are, in their seventh and eighth month right now. And I'm just noticing what I do in the morning with them. There's four of them. And two are girls, two are boys. And they are completely half Siberian, and then the rest is Alaskan. We had a Siberian come together with one of our Alaskans, but it was our best Alaskan, best lead dog. So if she got off, that was the best guy that she could grab. So we were happy about that. Anyway, I run them every morning, but I run them free through our trails in the woods. They all
one
come
at a time.
One at a time. One at a time, so they're off on their own, and I do see, and I enjoy what you're saying because I love watching the differences in these dogs.
Right.
Three of the four dogs I'm very pleased with, the way they run, their eagerness to run. They all four, however, come back to me, sit down, get a treat, and then run away. I mean, they all can sit. They all come when I call them.
Sure.
They all do that. But the one who we call Zadok doesn't really, he just really wants to be by me. So he doesn't really, he kind of trots down the trail. He kind of sniffs around, eats some grass, come back for a treat, kind of goes in between my legs. He'll run for a little while, and he'll run especially a little bit more if I've got our lab out there, because he doesn't like the lab, and the lab kind of pushes him on to run. But he just doesn't run like the others run. I mean, the others, like, just run down the trail like bolts of lightning. So
can I say
at this point that he's probably not going to make it?
Well, you know, I would qualify that. Now, did you have to do the leash test with these puppies?
No, we...
Well, we had them on leashes.
We had them on leashes.
Not necessarily as a test, but we did notice their behaviors early on with the leashes.
You know, if just from his description, my guess would have been that this puppy would have been what we call that group three, a more passive puppy. And that doesn't mean that they still won't run well on the team, and especially if they're well socialized with the other team members and feel comfortable with them. I think the proof will be in the pudding when you hook him up and see if he actually keeps his line tight. And again, patience and training could bring out quite a bit of good things in that dog. He just doesn't have the real obsessive drive, you know, for running.
They're good
and bad things, you know. Sometimes a dog that all they want to do is run, it's hard to get them to focus, you know. It's good to know that they're coming back to you when you're, you know, stopping and things.
All four, even the fastest one will come right back to me. As soon as I call, she's so fast that she runs into things sometimes because she can't stop.
She's a sweetie,
but she will turn and come right to me and sit down.
That's a wonderful characteristic. I just, and in fact, in our next session, I'd like to talk a little bit about that just type of behavior and how to encourage that, because that really can be very useful in training a good sled dog.
And so again, because this dog obeys me, comes to me, sits, those are, I should still feel a little positive about him.
I think so.
Okay.
Yeah. He just may not have as strong a drive, which means he's not going to be a lead dog for
No, he's not. But the other three could be, so I'm thinking I don't need him.
Well, hey, why don't you tell us a little bit about your kennel?
We, as I said, started with Malamutes. When I was 9 years old, I saw my first Malamute and knew that that was the dog I wanted all my life. And when my husband and I had our first home, he made me wait until we were ready for this, and then we did a little research to be sure that's what we really wanted, and focused on people who were actually working and running their Malamutes. And we were very fortunate to be connected with some folks out of Canada who ran some really good dogs. And from there, you know, we just sort of developed our interest. We did some weight pulling. We ran small teams. We did it recreationally for a long time. Malamutes are not racing dogs. We were fortunate for a while that there was a good freight racing circuit in Minnesota. And so we did that for several years and were very competitive and did very well with that, just because Malamutes are really strong, and the tougher the conditions, the better it was for those dogs. But we were pleased that they did so well. And David loves to camp and do a lot of backcountry travel with the dogs. He's taken them down trails that took him all the way up to Hudson Bay, where no person could go other than by dog sled, and they performed extremely well. They've done a lot of movie and film work and a lot of special attraction work for us here as well, and so it's been a good run with them. Now, as we're older, we're just down to four dogs. We used to keep as many as about 15 to 20, but always enjoyed that as a very nice way to enjoy the breed as well as doing other things.
So how'd you make a business out of it?
Well, what happens is that Malamutes are a pretty good dog, and when many of the harness makers talk about a large dog, they're not even thinking as large as we are. So we got interested in making harnesses for the bigger dogs. And when we would go to events, of course, the racers would all have their crossbreds and things. And then we'd have these big Malamutes all staked out to our trailer. And everybody would come over and ask about them. And then we'd start talking, and they'd ask about where to get a harness. And I thought, gee, this could help pay our way. We could at least pay for our hotel and gas if we sold a few harnesses. So with the help of some friends and things, we put together a little brochure and started very small. And then an artist friend of mine, Patricia Hudson, who has continued all these years to help us with our artwork, set up our first catalog. And it just grew from there. And, of course, nowadays with the ability to find things online, the web has just been a wonderful gift for people connecting with us, and we really enjoy working with people, especially those who are just getting started and need a little help, especially with their young puppies and what equipment they need those first few years as they're starting.
That's wonderful. That's wonderful. Well, thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, thank you for asking me. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much for listening, and we're just real thankful for Dr. Tim Hunt and Shalon Bedford for giving us such great information today.
And we also want to do a quick shout-out to some of the people that have given us some feedback. Tim McGowan from Northern Vermont for giving us great feedback on the Shoney stories, and also for just letting us know that he's been listening to the podcast.
And also to Becky Johnson Himes. She's a fellow musher, and she was our mentor when we first started mushing. She's also enjoying the Shoney stories and real excited about what the website looks like.
A couple of big shout outs to Dave Jackson from the School of Podcasting. In order to learn how to podcast, I went out and reached out to a gentleman from the School of Podcasting.com. Great guy, but brought up our show and told a lot of the other podcasters all about us on the Today in Podcasting episode 42. So thank you so much, Dave. So thank you so much for the show. Again, please feel free to go to the website, and don't forget the Amazon link on the right side of the page. If you do buy anything from Amazon, we greatly appreciate it. If you click through our website, it doesn't cost you any more, but it gives us an opportunity to pay for some of our bandwidth and provide some of the help for the show. So thank you so much, and we'll talk to you again very soon.
God bless everyone.